If you grab a Bible and turn it to Revelation chapter 12. Revelation chapter 12. We're continuing a series of sermons. We began a couple months ago out of the Bible book of Revelation. The name of our series is called Strength and Courage to Testify. If that title doesn't really make sense to you based upon what you know of Revelation and your familiarity with this Bible book, just I assure you, before we get away from here today, something of the nature of why it's titled that way will translate through what we're reading in the text today. I do want to remind you just about this text. If you have not been with us, if you're new to the Bible book of Revelation, it has a lot of imagery. Sometimes it has what we might even qualify as metaphor, symbolism. It's not all metaphor, symbolism, of course, but it has an important message, and it uses a lot of language that is meant to captivate the imagination of its first century listener. Many of the people in these Asia Minor areas that it was originally written to would have been illiterate. They wouldn't have been theological heavyweights. And so really, for us, we're not to read this with the cleverness or sophistication of a 21st century well-informed mind so much as reading it through their lenses and realizing that the Lord wanted to place some vivid, alive pictures in their heads, in their hearts, that they could remember the message that the Lord wanted to give to them in their day and time. Very important messages, not merely about the end of days, the end of times, but also about the world in which they lived in. The last days, meaning all the way from when Jesus was crucified, resurrected, and ascended to the right hand of the Father, all the way until now and beyond now, until the Lord brings history to its culmination or conclusion. And so, with that, just know that we can read this and understand this. Revelation tells us we can apply it. The text itself says that. And so it's understandable for us. And so we need to think about it in more simplistic terms. I know some of you are getting tired of this, and I don't care. For those of you who aren't here from week to week, just realize that if you want to have a phrase to attach this idea to, Revelation is a picture book, not a puzzle book. It also is a book of multiple fulfillments, meaning when a reader in the first century read this, it probably had in mind some things going on right then and there in their history. Similarly, we read it, and we should probably think of things in our history. But also, there is just a broader implication, meaning this is just how history goes. And so there's something of the cyclical nature of history woven throughout the pages of Revelation. And it is meant to strengthen us and to offer courage to us to be testifiers of the message of the gospel about Jesus. And so what I want to do today, I'm going to walk through really two chapters. I initially was going to try and bite off three chapters. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go ahead and stick with two. We're going to stick in chapters 12 and 13. And really what 12 and 13 do, they delineate two important truths. One important truth is this. And by the way, these truths are the truths about our great conflict. Our great conflict. And when I mean our great conflict, I'm not talking about just our little battles from day to day. I'm talking about what all those little battles and they're adding up, what they amount to, our great conflict, and all the little battles that are small representations of our great conflict in this world. Two giant truths about our great conflict. The first one is this. The first truth that this text wants us to understand unequivocally is that the war for the cosmos is already won. It is already won. It is won, and the enemy of your soul and my soul is already defeated. You know how sometimes Most of the times, stories will build tension to eventually get to the climax or the good ending that you're after. Revelation 12 does not take that tack at all. It tells you the good news immediately, that the enemy has lost and that God has conclusively won the great conflict for all of history. So let's start with verse 1 of chapter 12. A great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. You can tell immediately this is an illuminated woman. This is a light bearing. This is the people of God, the people of God who are meant to be a light shining of God's glory to all the earth. And so a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon, under her feet, on her head, a crown of 12 stars, the people of God, shining light. She was pregnant and was crying out in birth pains and the agony of giving birth. And another sign appeared in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns on his head and 7 diadems. We'll get to the actual who this dragon is in a moment. His tail swept down a third of the stars in heaven and cast them to earth, and the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she bore her child, he might devour it. And she gave birth to a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. But her child was caught up to God and to his throne, and the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, in which she is able to be nourished for 1260 days. Real quickly, if you haven't been with us, we've seen this number 1260 days before, and we've seen numbers like it. These numbers are almost surely pointing to a time of completion or a perfect timing, or to basically all of the time from when Christ ascended to heaven until he concludes history, the exact right amount of time. And so this woman has fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God in which she is to be nourished for 1260 days, where she will be cared for the remainder of time until God concludes history. And so what we have in these first few verses, really going back to the first cosmic truth, that the war of the cosmos is already won and the enemy of your soul is already defeated, we really have the short version of this. The short version is this, is that God created a people, and out of that people would be birthed the Messiah, the Redeemer of all mankind. And in case it wasn't clear, in case the imagery didn't translate for you, that one who rules with the rod is Jesus himself. And in almost as short a fashion as you can write it, he basically tells the story of Christ's birth, his life, his death, his resurrection, and his ascension in one sentence. As quickly as he's birthed, he's brought back to heaven. And so the details of Christ's life, death, birth, and resurrection are not really the things that are focused on in this text, but rather that he was born and he accomplished what he came to accomplish and was brought back to heaven in all his glory to rule with the rod. And the woman who remained, God's people, was nourished for the remainder of days. That's the short version. Now, what we're going to get in the next few verses is a longer version of this story. So let's continue reading. Now war arose in heaven. Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. Remember, we're being given a peek behind the curtains as to how things transpire within the heavenly realms, the spiritual realms that we don't always see and perceive, and how they actually work in tandem with the things of this earth. And so this war breaks out. Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon. The dragon and his angels fighting back. But he was defeated. And there was no longer any place for them in heaven. Speaking of the dragon and his cronies. And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent. Who is he? Who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our Lord. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they love not their lives even unto death. Therefore, rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows that his time is short. And when the dragon saw that he had been thrown down to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. But the woman was given the two wings of the great eagle so that she could fly from the serpent into the wilderness to the place where she is to be nourished for a time and a times and half a time. There we get a few more details as to what actually transpired in her being nourished and whisked away from the enemy. The serpent, verse 15, poured water out like a river out of his mouth after the woman to sweep her away with a flood. But the earth came to help the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from his mouth. Then the dragon became furious with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. And he, meaning the dragon, stood on the sand of the sea. So this is the longer version of what we read just in verses 1 through 6. Gives us a few more details as to what actually transpired both behind the scenes and what's transpired here on earth with the people of God, or the woman, as it's alluded to in this text. The longer version details three important ways that the enemy of our souls has, in fact, already lost and has lost as a result of Jesus' victory on the cross and in his resurrection. For one, and this is great news, especially if you come here today feeling just a sense of shame, a sense of overwhelming darkness, a sense of overwhelming worthlessness, because something lurks behind the scenes and accuses you. What this text tells us, the victory of Jesus on the cross and his resurrection, means that while the enemy was allowed to accuse the people of God before God in the heavenly realms before the death and resurrection of Jesus cast him out of heaven, where God will not hear his accusations anymore. He will not tolerate his accusations anymore. And so if you are feeling accused today, if you are feeling accusation through the sense of shame, if you are a follower of Jesus, the victory of Jesus has put us on notice to believe and act in faith that our accuser has nowhere to stand. He has nowhere to stand at all. He's out of heaven. He's gone. He has been evicted. God won't tolerate it. He won't listen to it anymore. You want to know if you're feeling that sense of shame today? One of the things I love about this, it doesn't just say the blood of the Lamb. It also says the word of their testimony. What that tells us today is something really, really practical. If you are feeling a sense of shame the accusation you shouldn't be feeling. This is telling us that you today can testify and believe again in the gospel so as to basically mute his power of accusation over you. Because the power doesn't exist in the first place. The word of your testimony based upon what Christ has done. No accusation can stand before you. Then we see that the dragon tries to pursue the woman, pursue the people of God. But we then see his pursuit stopped in their tracks. How? The wings of the eagle take the people of God to the wilderness. There's no question this is imagery based upon the exodus of God's people from Egypt into the wilderness. And so we've kind of got to get our mindset into those pictures, into those details of those events. The psalmist actually refers to the exodus as that God's people were whisked by the wings of the eagle away into the wilderness. And so we know this is the imagery he's trying to get across. And so what we're being told here is that no matter how much we feel that darkness is kind of pursuing and hunting us and kind of right behind us, overshadowing us, that just like the Egyptian slaveholders of God's people, God swallows it into the sea. His pursuit is swallowed, it is foiled, it is stopped in its tracks, and we are rescued to the wilderness. And really, the wilderness held something of a negative connotation for many of God's people for a lot of reasons, a lot of good practical reasons, but really the wilderness, in essence, is this life we live in. It's this world. And what we're told here is that we, if we are followers of Jesus, that we actually will be nourished in the wilderness of this life. We will be cared for, and that the enemy cannot pursue us and overtake us. He stopped in his tracks. We're also told something else. The serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman to sweep her away with a flood. Anytime you see something coming out of someone's mouth represents their words and their power coming out to defeat. In all essence, this is probably speaking of Satan's deceptions, his lies. We know that is integral to his character. And so he's stopped in his tracks. He can't pursue. He's kicked out of heaven. God won't hear his accusations. But he can still lie. He can still deceive. And so he slips lies. He slips deceptions in. And that's what he's going to try to overwhelm the woman with in the wilderness, in the desert. But the Lord again will have none of it, because we are nourished with what? The word of God. The truth of God. And the truth of God, the words of God that he has given, that he has taken himself out of the heavenly realms and inserted himself into our world and actually revealed himself to us, spoken to us, both in his Son, Jesus, and in his scriptures, and now also through God the Holy Spirit. His word overtakes deceptions and swallows them up. Absolutely swallows them up. When Jesus was being tempted in the desert, when lies were being cast upon him, and he just refuted them with the scriptures and the truth of God's words, the floods of Satan's mouth were just being swallowed over and over by the earth floor. They could not overwhelm the Son of God And because of what the Son of God has done for you and me, they cannot overwhelm us if we stand on his truth, if we believe and leverage his truth. His deceptions will not work. You know, all of this first chapter, chapter 12, it paints something of a portrait of defeat. A portrait of defeat. Anytime you feel defeated, anytime you feel like, as a follower of Jesus, you feel like you're on the losing end of things in this world, friends, pull out chapter 12 of Revelation and remind yourself, he's the loser. He's the defeated one. He's the one. This is a portrait of a loser. Enemy is a loser. The dragon, Satan, the enemy of your soul, is not a winner. Why is this message so important to the churches of the first century and by extension us and churches to our future? Why is this message that the war for the cosmos is already won and that the enemy is already defeated? Why is this truth so important for you and I to hear? Well, for one, to educate us. I mean, just real simply, to understand the nature of things, to understand the nature of this world, to understand that there actually is a spiritual war at hand. We are in a spiritual battle. War exists. That is the normal posture for life in this world. Also to encourage us and to arm us. To encourage us and arm us. Have you ever heard the idea that when you name something, it loses its power? It's just true. You name something that's haunting you, you name something that's depressing you, you name something that's just overwhelming you, you begin to strip something of its power over you. When you hide it, when it's buried, when it continues to fester in the bottom recesses of your soul, it just seems to snowball and gain power. God, in case we can't name it, he's naming it for us. And he's encouraging you so that you can just name it as well. That's a deception. That's a lie. That's an accusation. I've been rescued. You cannot defeat me. He's encouraging you to be able to name truth, to say it, to strip the enemy of its power, demystify him, expose him. This is to equip us to fight. And by the way, more on that in a moment. There's more to equip us to fight in a moment. Last thing I want to mention as far as why he mentions this about how the war is already won and that the enemy is already defeated is really to help us, to remind us that part of us being encouraged and strengthened to testify is that we warn and testify to others. Warn and testify to others. There are secrets we don't want to know, right? Some of you are fans of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and you are desperately just removing yourself from social media. You're nervous to be at church today because you know that there's some kid here who's seen it, and they are going to try to spoil it for everyone. You followed the NFL draft, and LaShawn McCoy already spoiled it on behalf of a lot of people. Twitter, you avoid it. Spoilers you don't want to know. You're going into surgery. You want to know all the details of the surgery, right? You want to know what's happening. There are things you don't want to know, but there are things you want to know. Friends, this is the kind of news that people should want to know. That the reason why they are sinking so low and struggling so badly is because there is an enemy that wants them as low as they can be. That there's an enemy that wants to own their soul. That their depression, while it might have some biological component, because that's true, isn't just biological. It's spiritual as well. And that there is an enemy that wants them destitute and on their back and unable to move and really unable to function. If you have the news as to why our friends struggle, why our friends go so low, why darkness seems to overshadow them and overwhelm them, isn't that something that you think is worth telling them about? Warning them about? If a train's coming, don't you want to warn the person blindly just hanging out, laying down, taking a nap on the tracks? Of course you do. And so we're told these things to warn and testify to others so that they know what's happening, what really lurks below the surface of history and our lives. All right. So that's one truth of this cosmic conflict. That the enemy is defeated. That the victory has been secured. That Jesus has won. But there's one more truth chapter 13 gets into, and that is this, that while the enemy is already defeated, he is not gone yet. And he is in an all-out effort, spiritual scorched earth attempt to take as many human beings down in defeat with him as he can. While cosmically speaking, these are truly nothing more than final skirmishes of an already decided war, Jesus does want you to know that the enemy of our souls is still capable of inflicting much harm on his way to hell. And we're warned of two key tactics in his war on the people of God and the people of this world. The first is this. Look at verse 1. I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads with 10 diadems on its horns and blasphemous names on its heads. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and his great authority. That word authority is really important in these texts to understand what this beast actually is. It's also important to know a little bit of our Bible, to know a little bit of the Bible book of Daniel. We won't get into it too much. I'll refer to it, but we'll get back to that in a moment. Verse 3, one of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth marveled as they followed the beast. And they worshiped the dragon, for he had given his authority, there's that word again, to the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who can fight against it? And the beast was given a mouth, uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God. Blasphemies, his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. We already know the limitations of how he can conquer them, right? But in some ways, he can conquer them. Again, this is the other aspect of the cosmic conflict. He can conquer them. And authority was given it, there's that word again, over every tribe and people and language and nation. And all who dwell on earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who was slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. If anyone is to be slain with a sword must he be slain. Here is a call for endurance and faith of the saints. So, we go back in our Bible, and we know that in Daniel, we see that this term or this idea of a beast is already floated, and the idea of the beast is tied to earthly kingdoms and earthly powers. And so there's actually four types of beasts mentioned, and it's different stages of different governments throughout history, identifiable governments, and they don't get into any details really here in that regard, but rather an amalgam, kind of a combination of those. Again, doing what Revelation oftentimes does and says, like all those specific beasts mentioned and referred to in Daniel, powers of this world will always, in some way, have a bestial quality to them. That powers in this world and the power structures of this world will have a bestial quality to them that are given to them by God, but also entrusted with the works of the dragon, Satan himself, given his authority as well. This is another reason why we know, not only by way of Daniel, by way of the use of authority, that these are power structures, whether they be governments, whatever they be, the various leverages and groupings of power in this world, in society. And this is a part of God's plan, by the way. That not only government would be a good to us, that is a part of his plan, that it would create something of a way of holding back ultimate evil, but also that it would be a conduit by which evil would continue to be poured out through the authority given by Satan that he has allowed him to have, so as to produce the kind of endurance in the saints of God that perfects them and puts them towards holiness. Our defense against the powers and structures of this world is our endurance and our faith. This is nothing less than what you and I would consider persecution. The enemy can't accuse us. The blood of Lamb says so. He can't pursue us. Jesus, as our rescuer, says so. He cannot deceive us. God's truth given to us counteracts that. But he can still make war against us. And an aspect of him being able to conquer us is persecuting us. And so, persecutions throughout history have occurred by tyrannical regimes. To this day, they happen. Don't get yourself into the mindset that because you live in a representative republic, a society that generally doesn't tolerate too much in the way of persecution, heavy-handed persecution, don't believe for a moment persecution is not alive and well in this world. Followers of Jesus die every day because of their faith, friends. Countries and city-states, the powers of the beasts of this earth are having their way. And they are persecuting the people of God. They are persecuting the woman. Over and over. And this is a way he works. And so the message, even if we recognize that there is persecution light that we exist under, whether it be an infringement upon our rights, or whether it be the subtle chipping away of the liberty that we've enjoyed for much of our history, to practice our faith. Whatever persecutions those are, we are to take them. He says, endure them in faith. In fact, to emphasize it, much like he said to the churches before, he says, if anyone has an ear, let them hear. Endure. Endure in faith. Every time a follower of Jesus endures a barrage from corrupt and evil machinations of powers in this world, he or she is joining in the war against the enemy of their souls. Endurance is resistance, friends. It literally is an act of faith that God ultimately protects his people from any spiritual harm when we endure against such beasts of power. But that's not the only tactic the enemy uses. He finishes with a second tactic. Verse 11. Then I saw another beast rising out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose mortal wound was healed. By the way, just a couple of asides. All this business about mortal wounds healing, it's just a reminder that earthly societal powers, they rise and they fall, but they never go away. They're wounded, but always coming back. They mimic or counterfeit Jesus' resurrection by way of their own resurrection. Empires always come up from the ashes, and they always will. That's what that's getting at. But here we have another beast. Beast Part 2, the sequel. This is what will later be called the false witness. This beast is a little different. It performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of the people, and by the signs that it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on the earth, telling them to make the image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. Also, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. This name, by the way, calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Not so much concerned with what exactly that is referring to. I probably hold to the idea this is referring to Nero or maybe one of the other emperors. But really what this is referring to is more the human persuasion end of things. So it's the Nero to the Roman government. Beast 2 to Beast 1. And the idea is that he is one that would wield and would command people's deeds and their thoughts or their heart. That's the meaning of having the mark on the hands and on the head, is that their deeds, their hand, and their head or their heart, their thoughts would be given over to him. What we have in this beast is something that we are probably far more prone to in our society. We don't have as many overbearing powers and structures to our world, but what we have is seduction. This beast seduces. This beast is almost a religious kind of a figure. And Nero would be that, for he would be represented by images in temples across the Roman Empire that would basically represent his image and be something of a mysterious conduit, religiously conduit power of the seat of Roman government and its power. And so this is one who would seek and seduce your devotions, your affections. If beast one is the stick, beast two is the carrot. Through subtlety, persuasion, and as it says here, deception. Sounds like a politician to me. The devotion, the affections, the deeds, the thoughts. When you and I devote our thoughts, when we take Pastor Paul's advice and capture our thoughts and do not let them be utilized and leveraged for evil or for simply feeling like we're defeated and going over the edge. Every time we capture thoughts, seize them, and cause them to obey Christ. When we do that, when we capture our deeds, when we do as Romans 8 tells us, and we kill sin where it stands, and we direct our deeds to obey Christ, we are actually battling the enemy. And we are devoting our deeds and our thoughts to God and His kingdom. We are literally making war against the enemy and his schemes in those moments. And He is telling us so that we will know the tactics of our great enemy, so that we, as He makes war, and yes, we'll conquer some of us physically in this world, that we will not go down without a fight. Chapters 12 and 13, friends, are a call to war. Will you go to war today?